Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us on the program for this episode. And we're going to be delving into the Wilderness EMS textbook a little bit more in depth with a look at some other chapters and some of the authors involved. And that's going to be a lot of fun because we've just been enjoying that. But before we get into that, I have to, of course, bring in one of my favorite disaster medical experts, Sam Bradley from, was it California DMET 6?
Yes, even though I'm living in Colorado at the moment. And here in Colorado, it's actually decided to be spring again. So, unfortunately, it wasn't the best winter for our meteorologist, Kyle Nelson, up in Aspen. But so he's kind of winding that down. So how's it going up there right now, Kyle?
Hey, Sam. Things are going really good. As you said, spring has definitely returned to Colorado. We broke 60 degrees today at the base of the mountain and actually just finished tearing things down. So our ski season is wrapped up at my resort, but still much to ski in the high country of Colorado. Talking weather-wise now, here with your disaster weather roundup, looking back really quick, about a week ago as we were recording our last episode, thunderstorms along a pretty big cold front from Indiana all the way down through Texas initially produced some tornadoes and large hail in that area. And then after that daytime heating was lost, those thunderstorms started to decay, and all that energy from those storms kind of hit the ground and rushed out in front and produced some pretty widespread wind damage along and east of a line from Ohio to Louisiana. On April 6 was another big severe weather day. East Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, 19 reported tornadoes, hail up to 3 inches in diameter in Salina, Texas, and tons of wind damage reports in that area. Looking forward, Mother Nature, another active week in store for everyone. The big focus right now is heavy snow across the northern plains and the Great Lakes region, ramping up to potentially be a pretty big storm. And then heavy rain along and east, everywhere east of the Mississippi River, and wildfire conditions, unfortunately, continuing to ramp up here across the southwest U.S. So that's what I have for the disaster weather roundup, Sam. Back to you.
Yeah, Kyle, I was surprised when we got a red flag warning this morning and it rained yesterday, so you never know around here. But I think last time we talked to Dr. Joe Holly, he was having a major thunderstorm going on outside. What's it like out there now, Joe?
Well, it is actually a beautiful spring sunset right now with a little bit of cool temps, but super nice overall, so no complaints.
Much better than last week. We were hoping it wouldn't get stricken by lightning. So we have another chapter in the Wilderness Emergency Textbook tonight, and we're excited about that because this is some stuff I sort of know, but not very well. And we have our favorite author, Dr. Seth Hawkins, master of everything, and he's going to introduce his guest tonight and talk about his chapters. Hi, Seth.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for letting me come on again. This is always such a pleasure. And tonight, it's really a particular pleasure and really coming full circle for me. I studied emergency medicine as a resident physician at the University of Pittsburgh from 2000 to 2003 under Dr. Keith Conover, the faculty member there who's served on the faculty since 1987. And when we looked to build a Wilderness EMS textbook, he was one of the first people that we turned to due to his massive expertise in this area. He's really known throughout the country and the world as a wilderness EMS expert. So just to give you a little background on Dr. Conover to introduce him, I worked with him in Pittsburgh in the emergency medicine department. He also has been doing and teaching mountain and cave rescue in that area for years, really since the late 1960s. So he's the medical director and serves on the Allegheny Mountain Rescue Group, which is the Pittsburgh group representing that area for the Appalachian Search and Rescue Conference. And that itself is a constituent group of the Mountain Rescue Association. So he's embedded into Mountain Rescue at multiple levels of that niche specialty. And then particularly interesting to us because it's so specialized and so unique, he also does and teaches cave rescue. So he helped us out with two chapters in the Wilderness EMS textbook, chapter 29, which is a technical rescue interface chapter on cave rescue, and then also co-authored our technical rescue interface chapter on search and rescue in global terms for non-snow or non-glaciated environments. So I'd love to hand him over to your listeners because tonight's going to be a real pleasure.
So welcome, Dr. Keith. I'm really interested in what you have to say because I don't know much about cave rescue. And you mentioned in your notes that most of it is, as far as medical care and rescue, is the same as above ground. But I love the way you started your chapter. Caves are dark, caves are cold, caves are wet. And then you went on from there. So tell us a little bit about cave rescue and how it may differ from wilderness rescue.
Well, I mean, there's the standard saying around here is that 80% of cave rescue and above ground rescue are the same. As a matter of fact, in the Allegheny Mountain Rescue Group, we encourage people to go to the National Cave Rescue Commission training, even if they don't really see cave rescue as their main thing, because it's a good place to get a bunch of search and rescue training that mostly applies. But, you know, let me go to something else first. With our mountain rescue teams around here, one of the arguments we've always had is, should we take someone who has EMS/rescue experience and try to turn them into a mountain rescue person, cave rescue person, or should we take someone who has extensive outdoor experience and get them into an EMT class and teach them the rescue skills? And there's arguments on both sides, but I think in general, the arguments pretty much come down on the side of, well, unless we got someone who's already got outdoor experience and has been in the mountains and running around, you know, we're probably better off just taking someone who has the outdoor experience and has been backpacking for a long time and is comfortable in the environment. Because, you know, it's hard to do medical care when you're worried about your own safety. You know, we talk about step zero being scene safety, and if I took someone who's never been in a wild cave before and take them on a cave rescue to be the medic, I suspect they would be so worried about their own safety that it would impact their ability to take care of the patient. And that's if you look, like you read through the chapter, it's mostly about the cave environment, not about the actual medical care, because that's what I think is important. So Sam, have you ever been in a cave before?
Only large ones.
They have lights hanging on the ceiling and stuff.
Yeah, maybe. But I've been in real caves too. But I don't enjoy enclosed spaces. Let's put that. But I guess
and that's one of the things too. A lot of people just, you know, in fact, in our mountain rescue group, we everyone is required because AMERG is not only a member of Appalachian Search and Rescue, it's also a certified member team of the Mountain Rescue Association. And so there's fairly rigorous standards that everyone has to meet, even above the ASRC ones, for the MRA membership as far as more on technical rescue. And everyone in our group, even if they're dog handlers or whatever, or people working in base, have to meet the same standards as far as, if push comes to shove, being able to do technical rescue. But, you know, for cave rescue, we don't have the same requirement. It is entirely optional whether you want to do cave rescue or not, because psychologically it's so different.
Well, that's it. And you really have to be physically fit, I imagine, and okay in that dark, wet, cold environment.
A lot of times people go into caves and it's all very claustrophobic and you're worried it's going to collapse on you. You're actually, and you probably read this in the chapter, if you read the chapter, that it's actually, you're actually safer in the cave from collapse like that than you are in a building or above ground where a tree might fall on you. I mean, it's just because, you know, yes, caves do collapse. That's one of the ways they form, but it only happens like every 10,000 years or so when some pieces fall off the ceiling. So the people who are experienced cavers, by the way, in the U.S., cavers are the experienced people, and spelunkers are the Cub Scouts with flashlights. And in the UK, it's the opposite way around, that, you know, spelunkers are the experienced people and the cavers are the people with flashlights. So the difference in terminology is one of my medical school professors said, you know, two people separated by common language. But still, if people who've been experienced in caves feel very comfortable in there for the most part, because once you get used to it and you realize how safe it is compared to the dangers above ground, and certainly the dangers driving to the cave rescue, which is really, that's really dangerous. It's just a matter of familiarity. So I think that, you know, one of the important points, and I tried to make it in the chapter, is that if someone's going to be doing the medical support mission for a cave rescue team, they have to spend some time underground and make sure they're not going to freak out and run screaming out of the cave, which can be dangerous itself, because then there's that 500-foot hole that you just fall into on the way out of the cave.
Well, you know, you make a good point, because she has probably been there for many, 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 many years, so I wouldn't be too worried about it falling down on me. But I guess you have issues with any kind of communication down there, GPS, radios, topo maps, any of that. So it kind of sounds like you're on your own a whole lot more.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things that we do, first of all, it's slower moving someone out of a cave than moving someone above ground is a broad general rule. It takes a lot longer. Just because it's hard to move people through the constricted passages. You know, there's all these specific techniques we've evolved, like, you know, turtling, where someone gets underneath the litter and crawls, snaking, where you get under the litter on your stomach and wiggle, or if someone just uses you to slide the litter across. There's lat passes, where it's a narrow passage, where you just slide the litter across. But it just takes longer to do all that kind of stuff. And so cave rescues tend to be pretty long, and they often tend to be pretty technical for a long time. Here in the East, we don't have really long technical rescues because our mountains are just not that high. The most interesting technical rescues are actually the ones underground, and sometimes just you have to do lots of rigging to get people through difficult sections. And as a result, and since radios don't work underground, what we tend to do is use military surplus NATO field phones and run field phone wire. And so that's one of the things that 20% where cave rescue is different, because one of the things that in AMERG or in NCRC, National Cave Rescue Commission, which is a national training organization for cave rescue, you get classes on how to maintain and use Korean War-era surplus NATO field phones and run field phone wire. NATO doesn't use that anymore. They use fiber optics and newer things. But for us, we can get the surplus ones, and they work fine.
That's actually pretty cool. So, Seth, are you a cave rescuer as well?
No, I'm not at all, and I'm so intrigued by this dialogue, because it really speaks to why we developed these technical rescue interface chapters in the book. We each have these niches and look with awe and trepidation and fear at the environments of other people. So I find it fascinating that we're on a disaster podcast talking with a cave rescue specialist about the supposed, like, insecurity and fears of the cave collapsing when, you know, disaster response specialists are people who go into collapsed buildings. And, like, you know, that is such a more dangerous environment from that standpoint. And so I have to mention that Dr. Conover is also on the Federal National Disaster Medical Response Team, the DMAT team for Pennsylvania, and has a very accomplished and storied disaster response practice as well. So is very familiar with the disaster environment. So that's a really interesting interface, I think, for us talking about this, that really in many ways, the reason we developed these chapters was there were so many similarities in the medical care, and there were these slight, differences, or maybe significant differences, in the environments that they would operate in. And it's so important to be adept in the area that you're in, and to recognize that really with proper training, almost any environment becomes accessible. And then you find, you know, what your bliss is. My bliss is not crawling through caves, especially if there's water and scuba and stuff involved. But I have
that's very rare. You know,
in reality,
those are exceptional cases. The vast majority of caves are muddy and maybe some water, but you don't have to, like, hold your breath and duck underwater very often.
Yeah, and I think that gets to that sort of social media, you know, meme kind of thing of what the world thinks I do and what my mom thinks I do and what, you know, what I think I do. Honestly, I would posit that, like, you know, a collapsed building structure that people venture into is astronomically more uncertain and dangerous. And so, you know, speaking from a disaster, you know, podcast kind of environment, that we've spoken before about that being a kind of a missing chapter from this book that we're going to rectify in the future. But if I was asking Dr. Conover to contrast the two environments, I would, you know, suspect that there's a lot more uncertainty in the disaster response environment than the cave rescue one.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, it so happens we have an expert in USAR. Dr. Joe Holly has crawled into plenty of small spaces in his career. Joe, you want to throw some thoughts out?
Oh, I'm equally fascinated, you know, by listening to the dialogue as well. One of the things I was just thinking about would be, I think it would be interesting for our listeners to, if you guys could talk just a little bit about some of the fairly unique equipment that you would utilize in that environment as opposed to some of the more traditional disaster environments.
Well, let me pick up on that, Joe. I'll give you a good example. Allegheny Mountain Rescue does both mountain and cave rescue, and we have a really nice, you know, people in mountain rescue teams, we focus on our litters because we carry them around a lot, like for hours at a time. Yeah, we have wheels we can put under it for flat trails and stuff like that, but a lot of it is just lugging a litter around, so we sort of bond with it. And we have one of the Junkins, the older Junkins, newer ones are a little bit better, and it's really nice for mountain rescue. It's really, you know, we hang it off of cliffs all the time, up and down the cliffs, load people into it on the cliff and stuff like that. But it has these ribs across the bottom, and if you use it in a cave, most of the time in a cave, you have to slide a litter. So those litters that have the bars, you know, going across the bottom, they just don't slide. So the standard thing that we use for cave rescue is a Ferner Washington plastic litter because it slides. That's a really important thing. Now, everyone likes to do that and uses it as a sled in the wintertime in the snow, but in cave rescue, you know, even though you're dragging across rocks and mud and dirt and stuff like that, being able to slide it is such a great advantage. So there's an example of something that's different. Now, here's another example. Sometimes you don't have room to get a litter through, and so we'll use things like a Reeves stretcher, or their, you know, sked, or sometimes even just if it's really tight, we'll just use a drag sheet. We just use a tarpaulin, and if it's a narrow passage that we can't get anything, even the mobilized patient through, then what we'll do to try and help slide them through is just put them on a tarp and have three or four people pulling either on the tarp or on webbing tied onto the tarp to try and slide them through the narrow passage.
Great. Seth, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'm just so the most interesting piece of equipment for me is the mute button on a computer, which I have just successfully engaged. So actually, not being particularly engaged in cave rescue operations myself, to me the biggest change in the operational equipment that you need are, just like Keith is talking about, the folks who have received the specific training to operate in that environment. My experience is this is often a multi-state operation, or certainly a regional operation that calls in people with a lot of specialties, of which I'm really not one of them. So that to me is the most interesting thing, is pulling people in who have the expertise to use the equipment that I'm more familiar with in atypical ways. But it might be possible to bounce it back to, you know, Keith for other kinds of equipment that could be used. I think maybe there may be mythic things like scubas, like, you know, that's kind of my imaginary view, is that there's sort of underwater diving, and I'm learning that's much more rare.
It's really very uncommon because, you know, yes, there are caves where we will, people, divers who do cave diving, which is different from cavern diving. It's a very specialized thing, and we'll go ahead and occasionally have to use that to get through someplace to what we call a sump, to get to open air on the other side. But that's pretty rare, and in fact, people who are exploring caves, let me just tell you, there's a group called the Descenders, which back, I don't know, about 20 years ago, they had a 50% yearly mortality rate, so trying to do scuba in a cave where if you just sneeze or something like that, you can, and twitch, you can stir up silt where you can't see anything, is really, really pretty, and you get caught, is pretty dangerous. So most of the time, in a case like that, it's going to be a body recovery and not an actual rescue. So the rescues that involve having to do scuba stuff is like extremely seldom. But let me pick on a couple other things you said, Seth. First of all, as far as cave rescue being different than disaster, it's different from other things too. It's a wilderness environment, and in any environment that you're in, you need to know the hazards. And that's why in the cave rescue chapter, I focused on the hazards and knowing the environment and how to read a cave map and stuff like that, as opposed to the medical care is the same. It really is. I mean, I've done lots of cave rescues. I've done lots of above ground rescues. The medical care is the same. I mean, it's more muddy underground, but you don't have to worry about wind. You know, so there's some differences, but the medical care is the same. But, for example, last year, there's a right near where I am in Pittsburgh and where Seth trained with me, is something called the SMRT, or SMART team, a special medical rescue team, that focuses on mine rescue, providing the medical support for mine rescue to the federal agencies that do that. And it was interesting because we had a cave rescue orientation class for new AMERG members, and we invited them along. And they found it had absolutely nothing to do with mine rescue. And the hazards were entirely different. In fact, Joe, mine rescue is a lot more like collapsed building rescue. You have to worry about the roof timbers and whether the human engineering is adequate to keep it from collapsing on you. You have to worry more about bad air and so forth and gas, in this case, natural gas, as opposed to leaking gas lines. But it's interesting that people think that mine rescue and cave rescue are similar. I don't know squat about mine rescue. I would be a total loss. I mean, they're both underground and they're dark, but that's about it. Completely different environment.
So this is Joe, and I would agree with you completely. You know, Mother Nature is a much better engineer than people are in general. And you're right, the similarities between those two, I would expect, are vast. I probably have more experience on the mine side than I do on the cave side. For sure. As I was listening to you, one thing really occurred to me, and I'd be interested to know, what would you say is maybe the most dispelled myth that is in your chapter that you would think that folks reading that would be the most surprised to learn?
Other than bats getting in your hair, you mean? No, they have good ultrasound. They don't. You know, they don't do that.
They all have rabies too.
Yeah, well, some of them do. But you know, in fact, people who spend a lot of time caving usually get prophylactic rabies vaccination because there have been a few rare cases of aerosol rabies from just being in a cave where there's a lot of bats, and some of them have rabies. So yeah, I've had my rabies shots, and I check my titers on a regular basis because I do a lot of caving. I don't know. I think the myths about, well, let me give you an example. Stories are already always good. There, near here in Pittsburgh, there's a place called Laurel Caverns up near the top of Laurel Mountain, the westernmost of the Appalachian Ridges, right to the east of us. And it's partly a commercial cave and partly a wild cave. And so what they do is they, you know, you can take the commercial tour where you just walk, like Sam was talking about, walking, you know, with all the lights and the path and stuff, or you can go ahead and leave your stuff in lockers and have a guide go with you. You put on some coveralls and a hard hat and a light and some gloves, and you get to follow them just clambering over through the cave and up and down and so forth. And everyone knows it's a little bit more dangerous, and I have to sign a release. We had a rescue at Laurel Caverns, a decade or two back. And one of the things that happened is a local fire company had been brought in as a first response agency. After that experience, now the cave actually calls Allegheny Mountain Rescue Group and Mountaineer Area Rescue Group, the two ASRC teams nearby, for first response. It was a woman. Okay, so let me give you the scenario, because it's probably, this gives a good flavor of cave rescue. So there was one weekend, 2-day-long orientation to cave rescue class being held at the caverns, because the people who own the cave also are involved in cave rescue and training people for cave rescue. And the first day of this is usually all sort of classroom and some hauling of litter around. The classroom is divided. You take the people who are cavers and you put them in stuff about first aid and rescue, and then you take the rescue EMS people and put them in stuff about cave environment, and then you put them all together to haul around a litter, and then the next day you do a mock cave rescue. Well, I was out there teaching the first day. I had to come back to the ER and work on Sunday, so I wasn't going to be there for the mock cave rescue. And apparently there's this 16-year-old girl who joked as the people were in the back part of the cave doing the mock cave rescue, saying, well, I hope you don't need to rescue me. And a little bit later, someone came out and asked them for help. And they were in there with a litter and so forth. They hadn't, because this is an orientation to cave rescue where you're not training people to use field phones, they didn't have any communications. So they were back to runners, well, not really running, sort of scrambling, with notes, which means that legible handwriting and good English composition is actually a really important thing for cave rescue. So this is a good situation for English majors to apply. And the note got sent out that she'd fallen and hit her head, was confused and screaming, one unresponsive pupil, blood coming from her mouth, possibly a femur fracture. And so they asked if I would get someone to cover for me in the ER and fly out there on the helicopter. So I did, and we got in there, and she'd calmed down. She had a bruised leg. She didn't have a femur fracture. Yeah, she had a little cut in her mouth and was bleeding from her mouth. Her pupil was fine at this point. And she was totally with it. And in fact, I took one of the residents with me because, you know, just like an attending in any emergency department, I'm just going to stand there with my arms folded and have a resident do all the real work. Right, Seth?
Exactly.
and she was very uncomfortable because she was in a sked ked. A short board, wraparound short board. And she was really getting a lot of pain from that. And I said, well, Eric, I mean, see if you can clinically clear just like you do in the ER. And he did, and so forth, and got her out. And she was much better. She actually got up to pee. And then she says she was really shaky, wasn't sure she could do it. So, well, we'll just carry you out the rest of the way. But much better. And the firefighters got very upset at the doctors interfering with the rescue. And they were so shaky about being in the cave that they started trying to rush on the way out, despite our best efforts to say, look, she's stable. She's stable. You know, there's no hurry. She's fine. She doesn't have any major broken bones. She has no major internal injuries. Her belly exam is fine. We've cleared her cervical spine. Her head injury seems to be just a concussion. She's fine from that. But no, they kept on rushing, and we ended up having two fairly serious injuries of firefighters on the way out because they were rushing. So I think that psychological thing is the big thing there, that caves are dangerous, and the most important thing to do is get someone out of the cave so they won't be eaten by the bats or whatever.
In this case, firefighters are dangerous.
Yeah, it reminds me very much of EMS, you know, which is pick them up and get them to the hospital really quickly so I won't have to deal with them.
Right.
Despite the fact that they don't need either EMS or the ED, but...
Oh, here's one of the things that we do with our this is sort of a side thing. We have something called the Ottawa criteria, whereby you can determine whether after someone twists their ankle, whether they need foot or ankle x-rays. And we use those. I even have a little card that's up on my website that we hand out to everyone. And all of our medics are trained to use the Ottawa criteria, because if you don't need x-rays, then you can just use some duct tape and strap up your ankle or whatever and just keep carrying the litter, and you can just go ahead and get an air cast when you get out, and there's no reason to do an evacuation for that or splint or anything like that. Just some strapping with duct tape will work. So we try to minimize the amount of stuff that gets sent to the ER by doing stuff proactively in the field, even with non-physician providers.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And yes, Joe, we like dumping patients on the ER doc so we can leave and go have lunch. So, Kyle, are you going to become a caver?
Well, you know, my cave experience is limited, as many of yours is, to more commercial ventures into established key systems with routes and safety systems in place. I haven't had the chance to go too deep into the subject myself, but... I was a little bit curious in the chapter about one of the subheadings that reads, caves may be psychologically stressful or downright scary. And so my question is, if someone is saying that, hey, I'm interested in, you know, getting into cave rescue, or someone wants to kind of get into that subject in that area of expertise, what is your ideal candidate for that?
It's hard to tell. I know people who are hardcore mountaineers, really tough rock jocks, high altitude mountaineers who are deathly afraid of going in caves. So you can't tell by someone's ability above or below ground what they are for the other. And I think, have you ever heard about, you know, desensitization therapy where, you know, they bring out a plastic spider to try and then, you know, more realistic spiders to try and cure you of your fear of spiders. Same thing. You go into like a commercial cave and take a current and then see how you do. And then you get together with one of the local caving clubs or like with Allegheny Mountain Rescue, we have enough cave people that we'll run our own orientation for new members who want to do it and take them to, you know, a simple, fairly easy cave, put them in there, get them lost a little bit, turn off the lights for a while so everyone has to sit in the dark for 5 minutes and see how they would do with that. And you'd be surprised. You can't tell from above ground how people are going to do underground. Because some people who seem sort of wimpy to you just take to it like a fish to water, and they're just great and just love it. And other people who are really hardcore, you know, outdoor people and hunters, fishermen, et cetera, they'll just sort of say, oh, this is not for me. I'm going to go home. Thank you. Goodbye.
Well, I think I would be one of those. Well, Jamie majored in Elizabethan literature and cave rescue, so we want to hear from him. Just kidding.
I put that in the chat because I liked your comment about English majors, you know, being necessary to pass good notes and things like that. I think it's important to really note, because I'm hearing a common theme here that we've talked about before when discussing this textbook, is really that it's really important in a wilderness setting to, just like in disaster settings, to understand the hazards that are around you at all times as much as possible. And that the chapter on this particular subject focuses on those hazards in a similar way that someone doing swift water rescue has to be trained and appropriately aware of what the problems are with swift water rescue. And all these things just come back to really an awareness of your own capabilities and the capabilities of the group you're with. Am I correct?
I think so. Well, you know, what you want is you want to be comfortable enough with the hazards around you that you know how to deal with them enough that you can put all your attention on your patient rather than all your attention on you know, checking for and managing hazards around you. So you have to have enough comfort. If you want to be good at it, you got to be able to really devote most of your attention to the patient and concern with the patient for both medical and psychological reasons. So, yes, you need enough understanding of the hazards so that, A, you don't get killed, but, B, so that you can just keep an eye on them with the back of your mind.
Well, I want to make sure we have some time for the second chapter, which is the search chapter. So now we're coming out of the ground and going up higher. It sounds like the gist of your chapter is how to make it work well. You have to get a lot of information. You have to do a lot of planning. You have to figure out what the right medical gear may be. Can you kind of talk about that concept?
Well, searches aren't that common. Trying to find someone is fairly common. You know, someone comes out of a cave or off a mountain and says, my buddy's up here. I'm too tired to go back up, but here's the direction. So sometimes you have a little bit of searching. But searching, a big search, doesn't happen that often in any particular area. And it's its own unique environment. A lot of parallels to a big wildfire as far as how it's managed. But the problem is that you have someone out there who's presumably ill or injured, and you want to be able to take care of them, but you've got 300 people going out looking for him or her. So how do you spread your medical resources among them, and how do you decide what to take with you? And not only that, when you've got that many people out running around wherever it is, in the desert, up in a mountain, in the woods, in the southeast, in the Smoky Mountains or whatever, there's lots of opportunities for badness to happen. Because, you know, it is a hazardous environment. And then something bad is bound to happen when you have that many people out searching for a couple of days. So part of what I like to talk about is medical force protection. And we talk about force protection in other ways as far as, you know, with, for instance, when I go out with the DMAT team, I remember during Hurricane Katrina, we had a couple of ICE police officers who were our security and bonded. We all bonded pretty well. And they were very nice, friendly people who carried AR-15s, you know. and some of those, say, the shaky places along the Gulf Coast and the New Orleans area, having someone like that just behind you, just smiling and chatting with everyone, makes you feel a lot more secure. But that's not the force protection I'm talking about. I'm talking about medical force protection. And in fact, in wilderness EMT training, we talk about bringing the – well, you know, EMS is the art of bringing the hospital to the patient. And if we could actually get paid for that, taking care of patients as opposed to just transporting, that would be a lot nicer. But that's another story for another podcast, I'm sure. We talk about trying to bring the emergency department out to the patient. Well, what you're doing when you've got that many people out in the field and you've got, you know, 10 EMTs or paramedics, each one of whom is a wilderness EMT, you're sort of sending a small urgent care center along with each of the teams. Now, again, they can take care of worse things, but most of the thing, I mean, okay, so what's the most common injury in the backcountry? Anyone know?
Lower leg injuries.
Exposure.
Yep. Ankle injuries. Well, exposure is probably contributed by this. Lower extremity, it's twisted ankles, broken legs. That's what all, and, you know, the vast majority of them are twisted ankles, which is why the auto criteria is so important to us, because it's such a common thing that we deal with all the time, sprained ankles. And we teach, and also people get midfoot sprains. They also teach people how to tape up a midfoot sprain, because that's a little more tricky to learn how to do that, because it's not as commonly taught or on the Internet. But basically, like, here's a good example. Let's say, and I'll say it's a team member who's a woman who is out there, and of course they've gotten sort of dehydrated, they don't take time to pee, and she starts getting some burning with urination. And let's say it's a wilderness area and the team is going to be out for a day and a half, and she starts getting burning with urination, frequency of urination, and urgency of urination, and then starts getting a little back pain and a low grade temperature and some nausea. Sounds like she's on her way from a UTI to a pyelo. And so that's a common thing, because people get dehydrated out there, and it's, and especially in the wintertime, it's hard to stop to pee. So that's a perfect setup for a UTI. So do you need to evacuate her, or do you just pull out your little wilderness medical kit and say, here's some antibiotic, why don't you go ahead and take this? So that's a good example of force protection. I mean, treating blisters so that people can keep on walking without getting worse blisters and getting disabled, that's a big thing. Some of it's even proactive. I don't know if you guys know this, but one of the biggest problems in the military at Camp Lejeune and other boot camps is soldiers, recruits being disabled because of blisters. And a guy named Murray Hamlet, who was the director of the U.S. Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine at Natick, Massachusetts, actually researched this and researched different kinds of socks and blisters, and back about maybe 10 years ago, maybe 15, did some experiments with different kinds of socks and finally came up with a sock, which the military now calls unofficially the Hamlet sock in his honor. And it's one of these ones, I don't know if you guys have seen Smart Wool socks, which have the sort of terry cloth wool on the inside. Well, it's like that, but turned out inside out and harder weave. Turns out that if you wear those things, then you don't get blisters. They really cut by about, I'm trying to remember, it was 20, a factor of 20 or something like that, number of blisters, by just having good socks. So sometimes the force protection is advising people what kind of socks to get so they don't get blisters, so they don't have to be hauled out of the search effort and not, and you know, and interrupt everything by having to be carried out by a team that is now not searching for the person. So that's sort of the idea of force protection for a big operation like that.
So, Joe, do you see a lot of similarities in that kind of search as you do in USAR, or is it very different?
No, I think we see a tremendous number of the same sort of issues, and I like that. I like that much broader definition of force protection. You know, I think that's sort of the go-to for everybody. Is I want a big burly police officer with a long gun there, and in reality, the team is in a lot more danger from a lot more mundane things, from you know, blisters to exposure, from you know, the chemicals in the water that you're walking in and the effect that has on your skin, the various amounts of stuff that you're inhaling and the respiratory issues that often come with that, et cetera. So I really like that much broader definition. I think it makes a lot more sense.
I will tell you, though, that, you know, we tend to use EMTs and paramedics for that kind of medical force protection. And they're the traditional EMT and paramedic training, and I know this pretty well since I helped write three editions of the paramedic program, doesn't cover that sort of stuff. So there needs to be additional training in that sort of stuff for both disaster and force protection and wilderness, and even for that matter, tactical. And there's, you know, tactical medic programs, there's wilderness EMT programs. And, you know, it's interesting, too, that the Department of Homeland Security back maybe 4 years ago decided that they needed uniform training for all of their assets that do wilderness, tactical, and disaster stuff, and asked a whole bunch of us to meet several weekends in Arlington with the Homeland Security Institute to help them develop a training program for them for all those things, because they said they're all so similar. We're just going to call it austere EMS, and yeah, this force protection is a big part of it, and we got to train people how to do that, take care of wounds, take care of minor injuries, take care of minor illnesses.
Yeah, I wanted to toss it to Seth. This is an area that you're a little bit more familiar with. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the things that we're exploring here really are speaking to the combined the Venn diagram we often talk about, with the ways that these different specialties intersect and the ways that they differ. And I think that I think it's really interesting for folks to hear about atypical uses of equipment they're familiar with, and then also atypical environments to practice these kind of activities in. And so I'm interested to hear the ways that these things that these things differ. And I think one interesting question for Keith and for everyone here on the call, I think, would be the accessibility of the search and rescue career for people interested in extending an EMS or a medical practice or a fire rescue practice beyond the traditional front country. One of the interesting things I think that Dr. Conover was able to bookend in the chapters he wrote was one of the most accessible specialties with one of the most esoteric. So cave rescue is pretty pretty specific, pretty niche, and often requires bringing together people from an entire region. I think, in my experience, at least, search and rescue, along with fire, may be the most ubiquitous of the activities that we describe in the book and that we talk about when we talk about austere wilderness EMS. So pretty much every community in some way is set up to activate people for a search. And so I would say, personally, bouncing back the question about how you'd get involved with cave rescue, if that was something that really jazzed you up, I think that how to get involved with search and rescue is an interesting counterpoint, because in many communities, it's so accessible. So for instance, in mine, that's the primary activity that the rescue squads are involved in. So I'd be interested to know, what y'all think about that as far as sort of accessibility and entry-level activities. And then also, I think it's interesting to scrutinize the chapter that Keith wrote for this and how scientific he got. I mean, the thing that really impresses me and amazes me about it is he took a topic that may be the most entry-level, and he built perhaps the most scientifically and scientifically driven and complex sort of system-based chapter of all the technical rescue interface chapters.
That's all you have to do is drop in some graphs and some equations, and that'll take care of it. That's what I did. That's all.
Well, I was impressed. Jamie, what are your thoughts?
Well, I like the idea of thinking about general search and rescue as kind of an entry-level thing, because, historically, I've got to think that's probably, the oldest rescue profession, right? I mean, people in villages hundreds of thousands of years ago had the need to go out and search for somebody that was lost, right? And would gather together parts of their community to join that search. I think I have to think that's something that started very early on as part of a community need to pull together people to do those kinds of things in communities. And so it's probably appropriate that it's an entry level way to get involved with this kind of thing. So I agree with Seth on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, It depends on where you are, too, because if you look at the chapter, it even talks a little bit about the geographic distribution. Because if you're in Nebraska, there's not a lot of search and rescue stuff going on because it's pretty flat. Or Kansas, you know, it's cornfields and so forth. So there's not really much in the way of organized search and rescue teams. It's primarily in the west and the east where we have more mountainous areas that it's easier to become lost in. The communication, cell phone communications are poor. That's where the search and rescue teams tend to be. So if you're in the middle of Kansas, you're probably out of luck trying to find a search and rescue team to work with and start getting training with. However, you know, if you're in the east or the west, then almost every state has a state search and rescue organization that has a web page and has information on different teams that are around and how you can get involved. And in fact, many of the states even have state level training and certification programs. So let's just pick Virginia, for example. If you're interested in search and rescue, every year they run a 2-weekend search and rescue college where you can just sign up and for free you get trained and credentialed as a basic search and rescue person. And then you can take that with you to whatever team and say, here, I have my state credentials. That's sort of like getting your EMT. Many other states are not as well organized. I have to say my own in Pennsylvania is not that well organized. They have some voluntary standards at the state level, but there is still a state search and rescue council. So that's the way to get involved, is search for a state level organization, and then they can give you pointers to the most organized teams that do training and so forth. Let me say one other thing, too, about that general search stuff. One of the problems we're having right now is that, well, with Appalachian Search and Rescue, we credential search managers, people who can run the operations and do the planning for a large person search. We don't actually, we always work under a law enforcement agency who does the they're in charge. It's their job. But we will sometimes take care of a lot of the management for them. But one of the problems we've had is that our people who are search managers, because big searches are less frequent now, are having trouble getting enough of them to recredential themselves. And we've decided that we're going to change. Well, anyway, I've decided I'm in charge, so I guess that'll work. I can probably persuade other people to go along with this, that large-scale simulations with multiple agencies will take the place of that. Because you know why? Because cell phones are changing the world. Because you got cell phone towers all over the place, and people don't get lost as often unless something happens to their cell phone. And so they can often find their way out or call for help. So the big searches are still there, but fewer and far between. And also, on the other hand, one of the things that we realize is that since they're few and far between, and even though we've got, seven states in Appalachian Search and Rescue, and we have mutual aid between all the different teams, that we're starting to set up something called remote support. So some of our members who have expertise in this but have moved away to Germany, for example, or another one's in Hawaii now, who are search managers and qualified as that, we can use electronics now so that while our people are driving out to the scene, they can be sitting back at home, wherever it is, in Honolulu or something like that, and start working on a computer, looking at the map of the area, getting the information together, generating the maps for different tasks to be sent out, generating the task assignment forms, and then electronically sending that to us at the base. So by the time we get there and we've got a bunch of people, we are all ready to send them out in the field. So there's some sort of scary stuff that the expertise for search management is disappearing, but the other one is that we're conserving what we have and doing remote support.
So, Kyle, you and I are equating with your world.
Well, Sam, a lot of similarities here with what's being discussed, and I think that to kind of back to the original question that Seth posed with the kind of if folks are interested or kind of how to get into the entry level search and rescue type of arena, is that, you know, it can be structured either as all professional, it can be all volunteer, or it can be combination, like many public safety agencies that exist nationwide. And one thing that I'd like to really underscore from my personal experience is that you don't need to be a ground pounder or an expert medical provider or a technical rescue guru to join these teams, because as Dr. Conover hinted at, there are many other skills that go into supporting an effective outcome for any search and rescue team. And that's everything from providing a remote support, like I do for weather and that decision support for teams that are in the field, aviation operations and things, you know, weather forecasts being a key part of that, but also on the communication side, you know, having people that are communications experts that understand what infrastructure is in place. If the team is going to a location, being able to adjust accordingly on the fly and determine what communication modes may be most effective. And just knowing that, you know, there are many facets and many ways to contribute to search and rescue teams, both professional and volunteer. So the best thing to do, again, do a Google search and ask around. Biggest thing is also you may come across a site known as the Mountain Rescue Association. There are a few teams that are registered with them, close to 100, I believe, but there are several hundreds of more teams that are often exist at the local level that aren't publicly registered anywhere. So do some Google searching, ask around, and you may be very surprised to find that there's a team closer than you think.
One other thing, because one of the things you mentioned before was the idea of careers in search and rescue. You know, there ain't no such thing. There's last time I checked, there were about 12 full-time search and rescue positions in the country. Most of L.A. County Sheriff's Department and National Park Service. The rest, however, if you're a firefighter, you're an EMS, you're a doc, search and rescue skills are sort of a value added to that. Because having those skills means if something happens and you need to get out there quickly and it's just your EMS agency, your fire department, and you're the one who knows the most about search management, then you can make a big difference by getting things started in the right direction in the first few hours before some other search and rescue team shows up. So having that to add to your CV is always a good idea.
Keith, one last question as we kind of wrap up. What is the what are the differences? You know, we think about long-term care in a wilderness setting and maybe a search and rescue setting where we have a patient for an extended period of time versus the traditional EMS care where we might only have them for say, under an hour or so, maybe even way less than that. What are some of the concerns that you need to keep in mind as a provider when you have patients for an extended period of time away from a major, you know, care setting like a hospital or urgent care center or something like that?
Well, that's an excellent question. And the answer could fill another three or four podcasts, but I'll give you a few bullet points. The first one is antibiotics. If you have an open fracture, when's the best time to get an antibiotic? And the orthopedic surgeons know that because they've researched it, and the answer is an hour before the fracture and as soon as possible after that, if not an hour before, because they're in the business of making open fractures. And so trying to get antibiotics into people right away, as a matter of fact, a couple years ago when we were out in a training exercise at a place called McConnell's Mill State Park, there was someone who fell into the appropriately named Breakneck Canyon. He's actually down at the bottom of the canyon. He didn't fall that far, but caught his ankle between two rocks in the stream and had an open fracture with mud in it of the ankle. And so I gave him 2 grams of IM Resef after we rappelled down in there to get him. Because it was as soon as, you know, I tried to clean it out. I'm just going, this is such a mess. I'll just rinse it off a little bit. And then they're going to have to clean this out in the operating room. But I went ahead and gave him 2 grams of an IM antibiotic right then and there because sooner is better. And so, for instance, for expanded scope, if that isn't a dirty word now with EMS, but for wilderness or even for rural settings, because, for instance, in Maine, where they have long transports, they use antibiotics on a regular basis. But that's one thing to get in. But here's another really simple one. What's the rule about food and fluids in street EMS? No one eats anything, no one drinks anything, supposedly because the anesthesiologist will have a fit if someone has something in their stomach and they have to intubate them for the operating room because they might get passive regurgitation. Well, it turns out that's sort of mostly bogus. And in an extended care setting, starving people and making them hypoglycemic and not giving them foods to drink and making them dehydrated is really bad for them, not to mention the fact that you need that food to keep up your energy, to keep your warmth up when it's a cold environment. So that does that give you a little taste of it?
Absolutely. I think that's a great place to start. And just I almost liken it to thinking normal rather than thinking EMS, because
I love that.
I mean, you need to think about, well, yeah, you, of course you need to eat every few hours and you need to keep, make sure you're still drinking and all these things that we would normally do during a normal day if we were just out and about, and we just need
to
apply the same lessons.
You got
to
pee and you got to poop too.
Yeah.
You know, in disaster settings, you know, sometimes people will have someone and, you know, they're on a really long transport and it's taking like 8 hours because it's a disaster. And you'll see someone, the ambulance stopping alongside the highway in the middle of all the traffic, and they'll get someone out in a C-collar and have them pee on the guardrail and get back into the ambulance. You know, that's appropriate.
Well, if you can't poop, that to me is kind of a disaster. But I don't know. But I think we have plenty more topics we can have with Dr. Conover, and I, it's amazing. I'm going to be about you.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and take it, Sam, because we seem like you're breaking up a little bit again. Dr. Conover, is there a place where we can reach out to you that maybe if somebody has a question about mountaineering, search and rescue, or caving, those types of things that with a search and rescue side to things.
Sure, you can put my email on there, and people can email me. But I'll tell you what, let me also give you, there's a website. My website's conovers.org, conovers.org. Which is a really old website that I handcrafted back in the early days of the internet. But if you go to conovers.org/FFoxtrot, little T as in tango, little P as in pop off or file transfer protocol, there's a whole list of like, oh, I don't know, several hundred, maybe 500 different files, useful articles related to this and other things, including a whole bunch of stuff on search and rescue and disaster that you can just look through.
And I think I have that link or some links to, related to that here. So I will make sure that's linked in the show notes for this episode. So thank you very much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks to all of you.
And Seth, where can folks find you?
So the Wilderness EMS textbook that both these chapters are found in has a Facebook page, which is Improbably Wilderness EMS. And we're also on Twitter at WEMS Text. And you can reach me on Twitter at Hawk Vox, V-O-X, or on Facebook at Seth Collings Hawkins.
Awesome, and we'll make sure we connect you there as well. Dr. Joe, you know, we've got a lot of things going on here, and it seems like there's a lot of specialized training that goes into some of these things we've talked about today. But, you know, in general, it seems like some of the training here is cross-platform, if you will, and some of the things that maybe Paragon Medical Education Group, our sponsors, are able to pull together with you guys to help an organization maybe apply some of their local specialized rescue skills with some of the major disaster situations that you guys can put together for them.
Well, you're right. I mean, it's some great stuff. By the way, the textbook is absolutely amazing. I'm literally reading it cover to cover and plan to incorporate a whole bunch of that stuff into our upcoming training events. So kudos to both you guys, and thanks so much for being on the podcast tonight.
Thank you.
Joe, where can folks find you if they want to bring Paragon in? Maybe, I think most importantly, talk to you. But I think people don't realize they should really reach out and talk to you and find out exactly what you can do for them, because it's such a customizable experience.
Well, you're right, Jamie. That's the best way to do it, because I think, you know, you're really only limited by your imagination. And I have a whole lot of new ideas after tonight's podcast. But they can find us at Paragon Medical Education Group on the web. You can find us on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group as well. And you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
And I think, Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social media places under the handle WXKyleNelson. So let's continue the conversation about search and rescue, technology, and all things weather-related as well.
What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me over under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations. And I want you to friend and follow me. Join us over on our Facebook group as well. Remember, just search for Disaster Podcast and then go ahead and request to join the group. We'd love to have you jump in with us. We post our episodes over there, and we have some conversations and questions going on in the comments. And we'd like to get back in touch with you and connect you with the right expert. A group's growing all the time and has a lot of great expertise already inside the group. So take advantage of that. Sam, hopefully, I know you're kind of breaking up here, but you know we've covered a lot of stuff in this episode, and certainly I think in these specialized situations, the medicine. One thing we've heard is the medicine is the least of our problems.
Disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.